this, or give a very basic example to motivate why we write it this way. And then we're going to get into describing what is the situation in hydrodynamics when you're trying to think about how to solve, say, sources that are interacting in gravitational with in GR. And why is it that we have split the course in this way? We discussed something the first week. The second week, I'm discussing mainly hydrodynamics, and we're not yet talking about Einstein's equations. We're going to see why is it a reasonable thing to do. And then we'll describe a simple first example on how to use all this infrastructure. So let me just recall kind of the picture we had yesterday. Imagine that we have our grid, the same grid we've been discussing last week. Except that now whenever we have, or we want to determine the solution at given points, imagine that that solution is kind of in a cell that is defined kind of halfway in between the previous point and halfway between the next point, and we're just iterating what happens in this cell volume. And this is why this method is called finite volume methods, because we're regarding every our grid to be composed of a sequence of little cells or volumes, and we're doing things there. We discussed that there could be, this issue of shocks and rarefaction fans, and we have to address them somehow. We're thinking of the equation written this way, which actually comes from an equation that we're writing well, let me just write it this way. Or maybe we can have a source. But the point is, we're having the rate of change of some variable of interest has to do with the fluxes that go across these cells. So this is going to be important in our discussion today, that we actually are forcing the system of equations we're dealing with to be writable this way. We're going to have to pay a price for doing that, but that will come. And the reason we write it this way is because then we can understand the problem as a collection of Riemann problems. So this is just an approximation to solving. OK, so we discussed that once we have this way, we're going to understand it with respect to variations of our variables, because that will allow us to write things with respect to gradients of our main variables. And once we have it this way, we had a recipe for iterating this equation, which involved a few things that we have to define first. We need to understand what the fluxes are. And yesterday, I replaced things by Q, but you see today why, at least for a moment, I want to give it another name. So let's imagine that for a moment, P and Q are the same. But we'll see in not too long that we might want to make a distinction. But let me just first so pictorially think of P as being the same. So we have the fluxes that our equation are giving us, evaluated at the left and right boundaries, where we actually, given that we're assuming that in each boundary, the value of the function of interest might be constant, we have to deal with the possibility of jumps that will be induced by these shocks. So we have whatever the flux may be coming from inside to that boundary, say this right boundary, the one that comes from the right side of the boundary onto that boundary. And we have some correcting terms, and we're going to motivate today with a very simple example why we need to include these terms. Because we have average of the values inside the cells, we want to have a knowledge of what the value should be at the interfaces, and we have these steps in here. And the slopes that we use to reconstruct the value of the functions at the cell interfaces is something that we also exploit or define in such a way that whenever we have a kink, we want to do the minimum possible job, because this would be across a shock. And that we define the slope to be zero, and otherwise we always take the smallest slope. So I need to give you the last two pieces of this recipe. These W's that I defined there and R are the following. So if we have the matrix A, say at one of the interfaces, defined simply by DFDQ at the interface, we define the matrix, which is the derivative of the fluxes with respect to Q. This matrix, or this value we need to evaluate when you want to have a well-defined matrix, we're going to evaluate four values of Q that are the product of what we would extrapolate from the inside of the cell to the boundary and from outside the right side of the cell to that boundary. So we take the average of these two. So in the case of the solution is smooth, we're just putting the right value. And if it's not smooth, we're taking into account the fact that there might be a mismatch, and so we just kind of give equal weight to both possible solutions. Given this matrix, we compute the eigenvalues, which are the lambda alphas, the eigenvectors, and which we call, say, R alpha. So we want A R alpha is lambda alpha R alpha. And we compute what we call the jumps. And you see soon why we need this, which are defined so that also to keep track of the fact that we might have a discontinuity. With all this, remember what we've done. Or notice what we've done. So if we're using the values at the old level, the best thing we could do with this scheme is just have a first order in time discretization, because we're evaluating things at the old level to advance to the new level. So we want to improve that a little bit. And for that, we're going to use a two-step method. Which essentially says, OK, obtain some intermediate values at level, at the in-between level, by this recipe. I'll tell you what it is, what L is in a second. And once we have obtained the intermediate value, we advance a full step. So we obtain a guess for the value that is in the middle. And once we have the value in the middle, we evaluate the right-hand side using that value in the middle and then take a full step. So now we have centered things in time. And where L, where I want to put this, just move this around. We have a source, so L is just the rows at the right bound, at the right cell, at the right boundary cell, and the left boundary cell subtracted, and so that's the account for the time, for the space derivative. Okay, we'll discuss in detail how this comes about. Let me give you an example, the first example, so that we see where these things are. Suppose we're solving a different problem. I mean, if we're dealing with a smooth problem, this scheme should do well, because we're constructing a scheme that will do well for a non-smooth problem. So for a smooth piece, it should be just fine. So let me, instead of considering one of these equations that will deal with shock, let me just go back to the advection equation and now change the velocity and put a velocity that is constant here. So let's just discuss very briefly how this will react or will behave when we deal with that, so that we recognize some pieces. So let's consider this is our solution, and let's think about the Riemann problem for this case as well. We just take a discontinuous configuration, initial configuration. Let's assume that B is greater than 0. We know the solution is going to be exactly this, except that it translates to the right at a speed given by B. And nothing more happens. There is because the solution, I mean, we're taking V is equal to constant. So at a later time, the solution Q of T is simply, let me imagine that the left we have this configuration and the right we have this configuration, value Q left and Q right. So we know the solution will be QL. And I'm going to write it this way. So at any given, let's say, well, this is this for B greater than 0. So let me imagine that for now we have a general B. It can, the shock can move to the left or to the right. So pieces that before, let's say B is positive. So QL will advance onto QR. So some pieces of QR actually get replaced and will be equal to, this is the other way around. So this B less than 0, this greater than 0. So this jump, the only thing we'll do is to say, well, pieces that I before had Q right, now when I subtract this W, which is the jump, the amount of the difference between this solution and that solution, when I put this in here, it's just replacing it in a piece by QL. And the amount we replace will have to do with how much time we're waiting to obtain the solution at a later time. So this is just one way of rewriting the solution. We're saying, well, for the right here, I have to the amount where we do this has to do with the amount of time we're considering. But the reason I'm writing this way is because I want to make evident that we can write the solution in terms of the jumps, so, and just seeing where it's going to advance to the right or to the left. Is that clear? See some surprise faces. Do you get what I'm trying to say? OK, so let's consider what the solution of this problem is. And for a second, let's consider the case B, velocity greater than 0. So this is our initial configuration. The solution at a later time will be this, right? So within this piece, at when I waited this amount of time, given by like say this delta space, let's say this delta x, divided by the velocity, then this piece of the solution gets replaced by q, which before was qr, now it's going to be q left. So I can write that solution as just saying qr minus W, where this W I'm defining to be the jump between the left state and the right state, or in this case, the right state and the left state. So if I now replace this in here, for that interval, what I'm going to get is QR minus QR plus QL equal to QL, right? So if I replace that's but in writing there, this is equal to QL. So it's another way of saying that the solution will be that this shock front moves to the right in this way. Of course, if the shock, if velocity is negative, the shocks move to the left. And then we would be using this one. This is the reason that we wrote that guy. OK, in this case, it's a lot simpler than that one. But why is it that we get a more complicated thing? Well, first, here we're dealing with a one-dimensional problem. Here it could be have many dimensions. The other thing is that when we, and this is related to the discussion the previous week, when we compute the eigenvectors, right, this will give us a sequence of, we know, well, let's say, let me just put it this way. Let me just think of a generic problem. So when I have an equation that it says, let's say U, comma T, or V, comma T, equal to some matrix V, comma X, which is generically what will happen. We said if we have a system that is sufficiently hyperbolic, because we own weakly, strongly, strictly, or symmetric, we know that we can write this in terms of another problem. So let me just change this to U. So a problem that would be, say, V, comma T equal to that some diagonal, V, comma X, right? So once we have that, we can always come back, do the inverse transformation, and interpret things with respect to U. As we'll discuss today, this is precisely the situation we have. We're not dealing with a series of advection equations. We're dealing with things that are much more complicated. But we know that there is a transformation in the background, because we're dealing with a system that is strongly hyperbolic, that would allow us to do this. So formally, what we are doing is we go into this problem, which is a diagonal problem. Now we have a series of just pure advection equations. We re-understand each one of those problems locally in this term. We find the solution in this way. And once we have it in this way, we go back to our original variables, because those are the variables that are the most amenable for our particular task. And so that going back and forth is reflected in this. So this, the jumps are the jumps that we have there, but the eigenvalue, so I'll tell you why the eigenvalue shows, but the reason the eigenvectors show is because that's what comes in transforming back from the advected variables, the v's over there, to the original variables, which are the u's. The reason we need the eigenvalues as well is because when I think of the equation this way, we're not playing the game right. The game we're trying to play is writing things with respect to divergences of fluxes, right, which will be the stuff that comes in or comes out. So I want actually to rethink of this problem in this way. Say V is a constant, this is how we would think about this problem is equivalent to that one. And so when we compute the fluxes in all these things here, we're thinking of B times the variable Q. It's a full flux. We want to see a derivative of something, a net derivative of something. We don't want variables to be floating around. And so it's for that reason that this lambda shows up. Okay, so I hope that kind of clarifies how we go about doing this. So let me first discuss this, the Berger equations again from this point of view, and then we'll see what the more complicated case. So now let's go back to the Berger's equations. Reinterpreted from this point of view. So our equation, we said is Q, comma T plus Q, comma X equal to zero. Okay, that's the first change that we're gonna make. We don't want to think of this problem, we want to think of this problem. Which now puts us at least formally in what we want. We want a total derivative or a derivative of a unique or a combined variable. In this case, it's just Q squared divided by 2. So now, using our original notation, which we have a problem that goes like this, we have that Q, well, is its own variable, f is 1/2 q squared, and in this case we have the source being 0. We can compute what the matrix is in this case. That's the derivative of the flux with respect to our variable, so the matrix A. So it's Q. This is a 1x1 matrix, so we know what the eigenvalue is. It's just Q. And the eigenvector is simply the identity number. The eigenvector, so we have R alpha. Alpha just is 1, it's just a number 1. We have the eigenvalue is equal to Q, and the jumps are QR minus Q left. So the rho of flux at the cell, at the right cell interface, is just simply so for this particular case, it's 1/2 q left plus q right minus the absolute value of q times r times 1 times q right minus q left. And this eigenvalue that we have in here has to be equal to 1/2 q right plus q left. So we're simply following the definition, what we have in here. For a piece, they are the same, they are the q's. Here, sorry, I made it, this has to be the reconstructed values following this rule. So that is what the code has, the one that you download if you have for the second lab. You recognize all these pieces. I think we have a tutorial this afternoon, so I'll be there so you can ask questions and we can play around a little bit with this. Notice also in the notes, because we sort of stuck some things in the in page 14, on page 14. There are typos in the reference to equations. So there are some pieces that are written in a slightly different font, and it points to two different equations which are which relate to this method, this update scheme, and the Roy flux. Those are obvious, but they have the wrong number. So I mean, we'll fix. I'll tell you what these numbers are this afternoon. And the idea is that we get our hands dirty with this, and we understand how to implement it in a simple case, and then we move to another more interesting one, which is what I want to discuss now. So are we good so far? Well, this looks kind of complicated, and when you see the code, there are several other functions or routines that are in the code, because there is a much more, there's many more steps that one has to do in implementing these things. Notice before, once one had a function, one took derivatives right away and iterated. Here, once we have a function, we have to obtain the values of the functions at the cell interfaces, evaluate the fluxes, make sure that one is computing this slopes in the right way, and once that is done, do an update, and then do it again to obtain a full step. So it's certainly more involved. Okay, so now let me discuss. We're going to discuss GR plus hydro first. We're going to discuss further concepts tomorrow, but let's take at this level for the time being. So we know what the equations are. So Einstein's equations tells us GAB, 8 pi TAB. We have the conservation of stress area tensor equals 0. And finally, we might have something else, so I kind of have to add this, but let's begin to count at least what degrees of freedom we have to deal with. So on the space-time point of view, or what will define the metric, we need to account for the evolution of our metric. We discuss one particular way of discretizing this in a way that would be a minimal to a numerical implementation. Next week, when we look at studying black holes, we'll discuss a second option, and we're going to go a lot deeper into how you iterate those equations and how we extract variable information like gravitational waveforms, curvature invariants, and different tools and quantities that we need to monitor to try to understand what the space time is doing. But let's just, for the moment, keep it at this simple level. And here, let's take a very simple and yet meaningful stress area tensor. So we're going to consider a perfect fluid. So we're going to assume that there is no viscosity or heat exchange. For the time being, and this one can always add later. There are some new quirks that come with that, but for the moment, let's think about this. And there are plenty of problems that one can do without ever going into this direction. So the perfect fluid, you must have seen it before. So it's written this way. Where we have the energy density of the fluid, the pressure, the four velocity of the fluid, all given. So let me just at least here begin to count the number of equations that we have, or number of variables that we have. We have the density, we have the pressure, we have UA. We also have, there's a distinction, if we are co-moving with the, the fluid, we can measure an energy, but that energy comes in two parts. There is rest energy and energy, internal energy, which might say, well, that piece of fluid may be hot. They might have other ways of accounting for energy. So that's going to be described by a variable, which we call epsilon, which is a specific internal energy. We have some constraints. So for one, if this is the four velocity of the fluid, it should obey a condition like so, where we have the signature again, minus, plus, plus, plus. So that's one constraint. If I count, so let's say we have one variable here for the density, one variable here for the pressure, four variables here for the velocity, another one for the internal energy. So we have 1, 2, 3, plus 4, 7. This equation are just four equations, so we have to be careful that we are maybe even able to look at the system because we might not have enough information. But I have one further equation here. It's a constraint, so that means that I have 4 plus 1, 5. I also have, I'm going to require that we have a relationship, so an equation of state. That typically will tie the pressure to the density and epsilon. For simplicity, we're going to imagine that there is something we call rho zero, and rho is going to be related to rho zero and epsilon in this way. So now I have 1, 2, 3, plus 4, 7, minus 2. So I have two conditions that link these things where I have 5, but I have four equations here. There is one that is missing. And this is just the equation that basically say the matter that you have, it always has to go somewhere. This is just conservation of current for the continuity equation. So these are the five, well, these are the, all the equations we want to deal with, Einstein's equations plus the hydrodynamic equation. Again, and in this week, we're just only concerned about the hydrodynamic equations. And one might worry that this might not be complete enough, that we may be missing some crucial part of the information because we're not talking yet about this piece. But I'm going to argue now that we're fine because of the following. So once we consider this and that, the metric here, and this we're going to discuss this part, our particular way of looking at the equation of motions for the space-time metric, is dominated or is given the principal part, but something that has second derivatives, second time and second space derivatives. So the principal part of GAB that is hidden in GAB contains G, and I'm going to put two derivatives on here, say X, AB. Oh, that's not a good notation. So we have two derivatives. So anything that is not differentiated with respect to the metric, that is not differentiated at least twice, we're going to ignore safely as far as the structure of the equation is concerned. Which is the first good thing, because here we know that because of these derivatives, we're going to have first derivative of the metric, right? Because the Christoffel symbols will show up. But those have only first derivatives. So just noting that the metric itself is determined by an equation that is governed by second derivatives allows us to ignore all the first derivative as far as playing a fundamental role in the problem. They play a fundamental role in picking up a specific solution, but not in the perturbation, the behavior of perturbations of any given solution. So that means we don't need to worry about things that have Christoffel's as far as the understanding of that problem, which tells us that we can discuss a hydro, at least from this point of view, without worrying what this guy is doing. Analogously, if I look at the principal part of div of t equal to 0 and div of rho u equal to 0, this has the fundamental variables describing the fluid appearing as d of, let me just write it like this. So if they appear fundamentally, the principal part, at the first derivative level. Yet the coupling comes in here at no derivative. Right? So for all intents and purposes, we can ignore these when we analyze Einstein's equations, and we can ignore the Christoffel's when we analyze how to integrate the fluids. So we're safe in just splitting these two as far as the discussion we're concerned. Of course, there are some proposals out there for other stress area tensors that will contain derivatives of, in here, higher derivatives, or when we include viscous terms, for instance, higher derivatives of this, and now the coupling is more complicated. But if we're staying on the perfect fluid side, with Einstein's equations, this splitting is just a natural thing. And we're going to take that as the model or the main system we're concentrating on at the moment. So the second lab problem is, again, composed of a warm-up and a series of steps to eventually lead to trying to understand ultra-relativistic fluids that are described by those equations, and try to find out what the general solution will be for a simplified problem. So let's work our way in that direction. So the first thing we're going to notice is that so the equations we care about are those. We just argue that we don't need to worry a lot about the gravity side because it's not going to play any fundamental role with respect to understanding how to implement these equations. So let's simplify our life and assume that GAB is just given there by the flat metric, so that we don't have to worry about that. That would mean also we don't have to worry about the Christoffels. But so let's say the equations are rho 0 UA, EA equals 0, and DB, TAB equals 0. OK, so the first thing that we notice is, let me just play around with this one. So we argue that our variables are all this. OK, this is not a true variable because it's tied with the equation of state. And say u0 is not a true variable because we're going to get it from the constraint. But still, all the other ones are there. So let me just take this one and let's be kind of at the brute force level, write this in the following way. And here we encounter kind of the first quirkiness related to what things that we have discussed. Notice that when I look at this equation, I don't have a clean equation as a dt of one of these fundamental variables equal to stuff. And you already see that I have two variables that are beginning to mix up. I have the u0, which again we're writing in terms of all the other ones, so I can maybe I could do square root of 1 minus ui square, 1 plus, etc. So I have a bunch of variables sitting together. I could attempt to take, to split this, use Leibniz rules, and try to see if I can get time derivatives for each individual variable. But the problem is what we just discussed, in particular u0 is obtained in terms of a complicated nonlinear equation in terms of the UIs. Furthermore, we want to resist the temptation of splitting this up, because if we actually split this up, we don't no longer have the divergence of fluxes. So we're beginning to be pointing in the direction that we may have to introduce some other variables. We're going to introduce new variables. And these new variables would be combinations of the original variables, and we're going to give them a name. And the goal is we want to keep things together both when we take time derivatives of individual variables and fluxes. So these new variables, we're going to call them sometimes the terminology is either conserved variables or conservation variables. And I really don't like the word conserved so much because it points to perhaps some quantity being conserved on its own. And typically, that's not going to be the case because we're going to have sources that are introduced by the Christoffel symbols. So they are not truly conserved, but they are conservation variables in the sense that they allow us to write, at least in the principal part of the system, something that looks like time derivative function equal the divergence of flux, plus the divergence of flux equals 0. And so now it is aligned with the kind of techniques we have described. So let me introduce another one simplification. Let's simplify. And we're going to say we're going to think of the ultra-relativistic limit. Rho 0 times epsilon is much, much greater than rho 0. And this we'll discuss in other examples next class or the class after it. When one deals with hydrodynamics, it's usually very important to look at what particular situation one has in mind, because there might be shortcuts that one can introduce by appropriate limits. And you'll see how they come about. So when we introduce this, then that tells us that the variable rho 0 is not very relevant. Because rho 0 epsilon is more important. So we're going to ignore this second equation for the hydro. everything we said will go, and it would be very easy once we have the R equations working to modify to also include this one. But we're at this ultra-relativistic limit, rho zero by its own does not really matter. And so when we define rho as rho 0, 1 plus epsilon, we're going to have that rho 0 epsilon is roughly equal to rho. And because rho is the one that appears here, we are safe by just taking d t equals 0. And then we'll make our main variable rho. So another, well, let's push things back. Also simplify it by assuming symmetry. We're going to assume something called slab symmetry. Where basically we're going to assume there is no dependence in y and z. So nothing, and no function depends on y or z. So we only have x as a dependent variable. Okay, the last thing, so notice this four velocity vector ua, we could write it something in this way. So if you're an observer co-moving with the fluid, you wouldn't have that. You just have a component here. If you're a generic observer with respect to some, or if you're choosing coordinates with respect to which you're going to evolve your spacetime, then the fluid might be moving with respect to those coordinates. And one way we can define the three velocity in this way and then relate UA this way. So we're going to introduce and this gamma. We're going to use an R variable, which is typically the variable that is used in the literature, which is called W, which is just going to be equal to 1 over the square root 1 minus V squared, where V is that guy. Or we can write it in terms of the component of the 4 velocity in this way. So it's a ratio of the x component of the 4 velocity over the 0 component of the 4 velocity. And we introduce variables, the conserved variables, or new variables. We introduce these two new variables. These are our conserved variables or conservative variables. Which allow us to rewrite the components of the stress area tensor in this way. So this, notice that the tau, for instance, that we introduce in this way, it's related or it's given by the time-time component of stress area tensor that's related to the energy of the stress area tensor. This one, which is a time x component of the stress area tensor, this is related to the momenta, and we're calling that s. And so we have this transformation, if you want, given our primitive variables, given by rho, p, and V, which defines W, we can obtain what tau, I mean, we can obtain this conservative variable tau and S. And so now with that, our equations are tau comma T plus dx of S is equal to 0. And S comma T plus S V plus P. Is equal to zero. And that's okay, we're doing, remember, we have taken the assumption of the space-time being flat. And so the only thing we're obtaining here is conservation of energy and conservation of momentum. Okay, in the general case, when we actually include interaction with the curvature, we're going to have sources because some of the energy can go into curving the space-time or vice versa. So in principle, we're home free, but we have to be very careful with what we say or what we think we have. The first equation is actually pretty neat. We have it in terms of the conservative variables, we have something that's closed form. I only see conserved variable here, I only see conserved variable there, and it's in the shape or form that we wanted. The second one, okay, I have it in the time derivative, but notice that in here I have V and P. V and P are have to be understood as defined through conserved variables in this way. Right, so they depend on the conserved variables in a much more complex way. Which brings up the first issue. Not only do we have to have the transformation from primitive to conservative, but we have to have the y back for many reasons. One is to evaluate these things, but also if we're thinking of the coupling with the with Einstein's equations, we're going to have to evaluate the principal part, the primitive variable to evaluate the stress energy tensor. Okay, now we have our equations, we know how to proceed. And we're going to see now why we introduce, again, some of the concepts before. Because now we're going to have to deal with a matrix, not have two variables. So our, say, variable Q is now a vector that has tau and S. Our flux that depends on Q, or the fluxes that depend on Q are S and SV plus P. And our source is identically equal to zero. Now the matrix, remember the matrix was the derivative of the fluxes with respect to each of the new variables. So the matrix A, 0, 1. And we're going to assume also a very simple relationship for the equation state. P is gamma minus 1 times rho. That's a reasonable description for a bunch of fluids or gases. This is related to an adiabatic approximation for the relationship between pressure and density. And I'm not going to write this thing down, but this expression is dp d tau and dp ds. I mean, they're known in closed form. And with that, one can find out what the eigenvalues and eigenvectors are. And they are, I mean, highly complicated, highly messy expressions, but OK, they are what they are. So I'm going to leave as an exercise to compute this and have the full expression. The last two things I want to say is the following. So I said we needed a conservative to primitive transformation. That's given by the following. So pressure given by minus 2 beta tau plus 4 beta squared tau squared. So this allows us to go back from primitive, from conservative into primitive, which we'll need all over the place. We'll discuss more today and slightly in the early part of tomorrow morning. For evaluating every single step of the Roy solver, we knew, for instance, in here, V and P, we're updating the values of V and P will change, so we need to be able to obtain them from the conservative variables, which are the variables we're iterating. We're iterating tau and S. And the last thing I want to say is perhaps the dirtiest secret of anything that involves hydrodynamics, which is the following. We pay more than one price when we use these variables. These conservative variables allow us to write things in a very convenient form as far as being able to deal with shocks, but we pay a huge price. One price we pay is the following. Suppose that you're dealing with a star. So the star has, say, some given density or some localized distribution of fluid. Now let's look at tau. So I have tau is rho plus p times something minus p. Let's assume, and it's a reasonably good approximation for a star, say that it's not interacting very strongly, this particular law. So it says that the pressure will be proportional to the density. So that means if I'm in here, where the density is supposed to be zero, I have tau equal to something that is better be zero and something that is zero. So tau should be zero here. But notice some of the things we're trying to do here. So for instance, when I try to recover the velocity, I have S divided by tau, which is going to be zero there, plus P, which is going to be zero there because the pressure, because the density is zero. So I'm going to have something that formally will be at the numeric level zero over zero. And things just go to hell left and right. So when one uses this approach, and this approach, I forgot to say this, are all kind of lumped in the acronym IHRSC, which is high resolution shock capturing. Methods. One never wants zero. You never want density, should never be zero. And so what you imagine is that, okay, if you have a density here, you're going to embed your star or anything that you want into something that is always different from zero. It's going to be very, very small. So if the density here is order 1, you're going to put something here that's order 10 to the minus 10. So many orders of magnitude below. And you can always check by making it slightly larger or slightly smaller that it's not influencing the dynamics that you're trying to get, but you better have nowhere a zero. So this trick comes in either two names, either a floor or an atmosphere. And basically says if when you're updating tau, you always redefine. So if you just modify tau in any way, because you just redefine in terms of your role, or because you just updated, tau is not the mean mode, it's just the minimum, it's the maximum, sorry, between the tau you're just computing and some value, the floor. So say if the density, if tau is ordered, it has to be ordered 1 for the star and has to be essentially be 0 for the other one, you might set this to be 10 to the minus 10. And so if tau ever wants to go below that, you force it to be something else. And you'll see that in the code, there is a routine called floor, which does precisely this. I mean, I hate this thing, but it's something that you have to live with it, or learn how to live with it, because it's perhaps the highest price to pay to use, to be able to deal with all these shocks and delicate issues that show up when you iterate these truly nonlinear equations. Any questions? So if not, we'll stop here. We'll see you in the afternoon in the tutorial. We're going to discuss a little bit more about this tomorrow, and then go back now to the formal level and now discuss. Then now that we kind of have a feeling of how to iterate the equations, we have a feeling of what particular issues we have to be mindful of when we're even trying to put this numerically, or even before that, discussing this theorem at the analytical level, we're going to use that to now go deeper and discuss some topics of leading edge research, if you want, some things that are lingering out there that might have connections to all sort of applications. And, okay, let's stop here.